Hello?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. Thank you very much for this accommodation. I very much appreciate it.
Yes, and I'm sure Ms. Nagel also was gracious enough to accommodate you as well. And so...
And I appreciate both her and Ms. Powers' cooperation and flexibility in allowing me to do this.
Wonderful. Okay, so the matter we have before us now is the cuff matter?
Yes.
So, Ms. Nagel, how much time would you like to reserve?
3 minutes, please.
All righty. You may begin whenever you wish.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, I am Patricia Nagel, appearing on behalf of Mr. Askia Cuff. Mr. Cuff is appealing his the trial court's denial of his motion to withdraw his guilty pleas. He has asserted the fact that the pleas were based upon coercion and fear, that he was not properly advised regarding the potential defenses that he may have, and that he does, in fact, have a reasonable defense. There is no prejudice to the Commonwealth, and that the court abused its discretion in denying that motion. If I can start with the coercion issue, and I will just quote Paris, because Paris and Justice seem to be the leading cases on this point. They've been cited throughout all of the other cases. And in Paris, the court stated that the plea of guilty to a serious felony charge, which is what we have here, should be freely and voluntarily made and entered by the accused without a semblance of coercion and without fear or duress of any kind. And the accused should be permitted to withdraw a plea of guilty entered inadvisedly when application, therefore, is duly made in good faith and sustained by proofs and a proper offer is made to go to trial on a plea of not guilty. So if we start here...
I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument. In reference to this matter, when you're talking about somebody's potential exposure to a harsher sentence, that's not something that would be under coercion, is it? I mean, our case law is pretty clear that that's not something that would be considered.
No, we're talking coercion in terms of the threat, or what we characterize, or the way Mr. Cuff interpreted as the threat or statement by Mr. Greenspun that if he did not accept this plea agreement and go to trial, that he would withdraw from his case and as his counsel.
But
that's the coercion
decided,
we're talking about.
Wasn't that decided against Mr. Cuff by the trial court? The trial court didn't find coercion.
That's correct.
That's a fact. We can't reverse, can we?
Well, she decided that it's her discretion to decide whether or not he
can't reverse it at this level, can we?
I'm sorry?
We can't reverse it at this level. We don't have the witnesses here in order to even make such a...
Well, we have the record, and we have the testimony of Mr.
credibility.
I'm sorry?
On a credibility issue.
We have the statement or admission by trial counsel that he did, in fact...
He did not admit that he could... He didn't make an admission on it. The legal issue of coercion, as I read the record.
He made a admission of a factual issue, yes.
But let me go on to something else, because this is what really, I think, interests me more. Don't you still have to show, on behalf of your client, that the effort to withdraw the plea has to be made in good faith?
Yes, of course.
And you have to show a reasonable basis, a basis for a reasonable defense.
Yes.
And in light of the evidence taken in the best light in favor of the Commonwealth, all of it,
mm-hmm.
all of it, including his admission later that he in fact did commit the crime to an inmate, and in light of all the physical evidence that is inconsistent with consent. This defense was consent. And in light of the case law that says credibility as a basis for withdrawal of a plea is not sufficient, how do you get to a reasonable basis for defense and good faith?
Well,
good faith on the admission alone, I think, is kind of difficult, is it not?
I'm sorry, good faith on?
Finding of good faith on the part of an appellate who admits to the crime would be hard to sustain, would it not?
There is no evidence of an admission to a crime.
Well, maybe I misread the record.
What we have is an inmate who states that he received a letter. Is that what the court is referring to? Yes. This is an inmate who states or asserts that he received a letter from Mr. Cuff. asking him to meet him in the shower. In the letter, he made no admissions about anything other than meet me in the shower. The inmate then goes on to proffer what his testimony would have been had he gone to trial, which is once in the shower, Mr. Cuff makes certain admissions, but he doesn't really say what those admissions are. So the evidence that was before the court is a letter that's unsigned, undated, that cannot be authenticated, that where Mr. Cuff says, meet me in the shower and tell you all about the case. That's not credible evidence, I would submit,
well, let's move on
of an
to
admission.
Else, but I will double-check that. I understand that is in the record.
Yes, it's in the appendix.
But the ability to show a reasonable basis for a substantive defense in light of the evidence viewed, again, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, where do you find consent in all of that?
Consent?
Isn't that his defense?
His defense, or what would be a reasonable defense, is basically the DNA evidence that's found on the towel that suggests the presence of a male other than Mr. Cuff. In the record, the complainant stated that during this so-called altercation, or the evidence of this so-called rape, is that Mr. Cuff removed a condom and ejaculated on her face and hair, and that she used a towel off of the floor to wipe and clean herself up. But that towel, once submitted to the state lab, came back showing the presence of DNA or semen or sperm that is attributed to a male other than Mr. Cuff.
But there was also DNA that was attributable to the appellant, to your client as well.
Of course, but we're talking about whether or not there is any reasonable basis at all to proceed to trial.
Well, no, it's not any reasonable basis. It's any reasonable defense.
Well, if you look at the original language in Paris, it talks about any reasonable basis, and I understand we're interpreting that to mean any reasonable defense. But it seems to me...
Well, that's not me interpreting it. That's subsequent case law that specifically defines it as a reasonable defense.
Of course. Specifically Branch versus Commonwealth.
Well, I would distinguish Branch. I'm kind of getting off point here, but I have a line of cases that I can go through with the court where I'm distinguishing these are Commonwealth's cases versus the cases that the defense is relying on. And in that Branch case, Branch did not have a reasonable defense because he simply disagreed with the testimony of the complainant in the sense that he states that she was not retarded and therefore capable of consenting. However, all of the medical testimony showed that she was retarded and she was not capable of consenting. So this is branches a situation where he merely disagrees with the evidence. That is not a reasonable defense.
I mentioned Branch not to get into an evaluation of whether factually it met the standard, but because of its language.
Well,
the language clearly says there has to be not only good faith, but a reasonable basis that the defendant can present substantive defenses to the charges.
And I would submit to the court that having
scientific
evidence of the presence
with
of
his DNA on it.
That was not on the towel, Judge. I believe that his DNA was found on a condom. Yes, ma'am.
So you have a towel with no DNA and a condom with his DNA. That's found in the room.
No, Judge. The towel does have DNA. In fact, it has the semen.
I said it doesn't have his DNA.
Yes, it does not have. I'm sorry, but you said no DNA. There is a towel but I think the court is to consider the fact of what the trial court was hearing, and she says she's familiar with the record, and as she should be. There were lots of pleadings that were filed up until this time, and one of which is the complainant describing that after the attack, she used a towel to clean herself up. And obviously, that's why they would have submitted that towel to the lab in order to show that the semen that she wiped off of herself was that of Mr. Cuff, and she stated that it was he who had committed that act. Well, the scientific evidence totally undermines that, exonerates him. I would think that is a reasonable defense that you could take to a fact finder to determine, was it in fact Mr. Cuff who committed this offense, or was it the male whose DNA is on the towel?
And what it really Hernandez, does is test her credibility on that issue.
I'm sorry?
Doesn't it? What it really does is test her credibility on that particular point.
It's not just an impeachment matter. I think it's substantive evidence that someone other than Mr. Cuff committed that offense. I mean, this is not a he said, she said. This is actual scientific evidence that supports the fact that, you know, his position that it was not he. And in the Hernandez case, the court stated the issue is not whether a court thinks a jury or other fact finder would necessarily accept the defense, but rather whether the proffered defense is one that the law would recognize as such.
Well, Hernandez is a little bit different, though, because in Hernandez, essentially what occurred is that the trial judge made a determination about the credibility of two expert witnesses and essentially taking it out of the province of a fact finder.
Well, I'm just, you know, again, this is Hernandez. This is just a basic law that applies to this area.
I understand, but I think that you can't just use the facts or the law without having it framed by the facts. And I'm simply saying that the factual basis in Hernandez was slightly different because where the court came into play in that matter is you had two expert witnesses, two psychiatrists, and his sanity at the time of the offense was at issue, and the court made a credibility determination about this medical evidence in terms of the reasonable defense. And Hernandez essentially said, if you've got information and evidence that provides a reasonable defense, then it cannot essentially be shortcut. That's something that should go forward in reference to whether they've met that standard or prong. That's actually different than what we have here.
That's the same thing we have here. We have scientific evidence that meets that prong, the DNA evidence on the towel. Again, this is not a credibility issue of he said, she said. We have actual physical evidence. It's substantive evidence. It's not even though it is also impeachment evidence, it is evidence to show that someone other than Mr. Cuff committed this offense. And then when you tie that in with the Facebook evidence, which had not been admitted yet, but the court had granted a hearing to determine whether or not that would be.
We can't consider the Facebook evidence because that was not presented to the trial court, so arguably isn't that waived?
No. The trial court indicated it is familiar with this record and everything in it, and the court is bound by that assertion. So to the extent that that is part of the record and the court considered all of that, it is not waived, and it is properly a factor that this court can consider because presumably it's one that the trial court considered. Because it,
Ms. Dingell, I hate to interrupt you, enter your rebuttal time. If you wish to continue, okay. Certainly may, but I don't want to preclude you from having the opportunity.
I'll reserve. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Adolfo, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. May it please the court, good afternoon. Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth. I suggest that the best and narrowest ground to affirm the trial court's ruling in Cuff's case is Cuff's failure to assign error to the trial court's finding of prejudice to the Commonwealth. Small v. Commonwealth held that prejudice to the Commonwealth was a relevant factor in determining whether a defendant should be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. And although, in Small, the Supreme Court of Virginia addressed both prejudice to the Commonwealth and Small's reasonable defense, it cited favorably Hubbard for the proposition that a pre-sentencing motion to withdraw may appropriately be denied where there was significant prejudice to the Commonwealth. Moreover, in Small, it's fair to say that the trial court basically only stated prejudice to the Commonwealth as its basis for denying the motion to withdraw. It was the Court of Appeals that found that the defendant also did not have a reasonable defense, and the Supreme Court of Virginia then addressed both of those issues.
Ms. Adolfio, I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument. In reference to Small, though, Small just indicates that prejudice to the Commonwealth can be a factor. It's not determinative.
I suggest that it is determinative. In the trial court in Small held that only prejudice to the Commonwealth was the basis for denying the motion. And again, Small cited favorably Hubbard for the proposition that a pre-sentencing motion to withdraw may appropriately be denied where there was significant prejudice to the Commonwealth. I recognize that Small addressed both the prejudice to the Commonwealth and whether or not Small had reasonable defenses, but I suggest that those are alternative rulings and that merely finding prejudice to the Commonwealth was a sufficient basis for denying a motion.
Yes, but that's not what Small says. Small indicates that there is a balancing between all of those factors and that prejudice to the Commonwealth can be a consideration. It's not determinative. How do you read that as not the central part of the holding in reference to considering all of the factors and not just the prejudice element?
The court want to make sure I cite the correct language from Small. Small said, Small says that for the first time, they are agreeing with the Court of Appeals earlier decision that prejudice was a factor to that ought to be considered.
Yes,
I think that it does not explicitly state that there's a balancing test. I think that it merely addressed both alternative holdings.
So are you saying that in cases it's Judge Annunziata, I'm sorry, where in cases where the defense has put up a strong argument that she has a reasonable basis for being retried because the defense is reasonably strong, let's say, that even though there's prejudice to the Commonwealth, that would not be a ground upon which to allow the withdrawal of the plea? That as long as there's prejudice to the Commonwealth, even in the face of a reasonable basis for a defense, I assume that means for innocence, one could still, the court could still deny the motion to withdraw the plea. That's what you're saying those cases stand for, Smith and Hubbard.
I think that you must challenge every basis. I think that a defendant must challenge every basis, and when they fail to challenge a finding of prejudice, then they fail to challenge every basis for denial of.
Could such a motion be denied completely or solely on the ground that there is no reasonable basis of a defense being made? Does one have to even address prejudice if, in a motion to withdraw a plea, the defendant has not provided a ground upon which the court can say there is a reasonable basis of a defense without ever even dealing with prejudice?
The court may also deny a motion to withdraw when there is no reasonable basis to mount a defense.
That would be essentially tantamount to finding that the motion to withdraw the guilty plea is not made in good faith. Is that a fair statement?
That's fair, Your Honor.
Could you clarify one issue for me? I thought I read that in the record the defendant admitted to committing the offense. Did I misinterpret something?
He admitted to the inmate that his girlfriend had fabricated the Facebook post. And I'm sorry, if you give me one moment, I'll pull up the appendix site. And it was at 568.
Okay.
And the inmate had also had the unsigned letters where cops asked the inmate to help him beat the system. And I don't have any specific... Well, cops had essentially admitted that he committed the crimes to grade one.
Okay, say that more slowly. What was that? I'm sorry. He admitted
cops essentially admitted that he committed the crimes to his trial counsel, Peter Greenspun. He was trying to figure out legal loopholes to get out of the crimes, but he certainly didn't deny to Greenspun that he had committed the crimes. He was talking to Peter Greenspun about minor issues, like, he told Peter Greenspun that I did not break and enter, and I didn't actually, and he was also challenging some of the charges because he was a principal in the second offense versus the individual who actually committed the offense. But Greenspan just explained to him his culpability given his status as a principal in given his status as the co-defendant.
Weren't they also working on a consent defense? Not that the crime.
I think that Greenspan had discounted the usefulness of the consent defense, given what Cuff had told him and what the evidence was against him.
No,
Greenspan basically said that while.
But initially, did I misunderstand that Mr. Cuff was trying to argue the two women had consented to the sexual assaults, violations, the rapes? No?
I think that originally the goal was that Peter Greenspan was going to announce the defense. I think that that's fair given when the Facebook posts were perhaps still in play, but after Peter Greenspan was not able to track down the witness who claimed that she took the screenshot of the Facebook post, I think it's fair to say that defense was abandoned. And at some point, and throughout from the very beginning, while Greenspan was attempting to both launch a substantive defense, he was also working to negotiate a plea that was less than the one that had been previously negotiated by the Office of the Public Defender. The Office of the Public Defender had negotiated a plea of approximately 20 years, and Compton said that he was not willing to take that, and that he would have been very grateful if Peter Greenspan was able to negotiate a plea of somewhere in the range of 14 or 15, and eventually he said that he would only agree to a plea agreement wherein he'd be sentenced to an active sentence of 12 and a half years, and with good time he would serve less than that. I suggest that the court's already touched on this briefly, but to turn aside from my earlier prejudice argument, I should just briefly address the trial court's ruling should not be reversed because the trial court correctly held that the motion was not made in good faith. The trial court had the opportunity to hear all of the testimony of the witnesses, and it correctly found that the plea was not entered through fear of coercion. And essentially, the trial court found that that Peter Greenspan had not threatened to withdraw as counsel in a serious way or in a genuine way, and that he had said that he would represent the defendant at trial if the defendant rejected the guilty plea. The claim that the defendant viewed the quote-unquote threat as genuine is belied by his answer during the motions hearing when his counsel asked him point blank if he believes that the threat was genuine. And at the time, the defendant basically said that Greenspan shouldn't have made a joke like that given the circumstances. And that response was, one, not responsive, and two, indicates he forewent his opportunity to say yes, that he thought the defendant's, Greenspan's statement was correct. And the trial court, to address the second portion of this analysis, the trial court also did not err in finding that the defenses proffered by the defendant were not reasonable. The defenses offered by Cuff were not supported by either credible testimony or affidavits, nor were they based upon a proposition of law. They essentially came down to challenging the victim's credibility. And to the extent that in oral argument, counsel has suggested again that the Facebook post could be considered by this court and were considered by the trial court. I just point out the Tennessee Pages 567 through 568. 2004, where the House essentially shut down any discussion of the Facebook post, or attempted to shut down any discussion of the Facebook post during motion's argument with respect to the motion to withdraw. And unless the court has any other questions, I reiterate that the defendant's motion to withdraw was made neither in good faith nor was it based on defenses that were reasonable, and I'd ask that you affirm the decision of the trial court.
Judge Nguyen, do you have any other questions?
I have no other questions. Thank you.
Judge Etlin?
No, ma'am.
Ms. Nagel?
Yeah.
Thank you. I think essentially, if you have objective scientific evidence, DNA, that suggests the presence of someone other than Mr. Cuff at the scene, I think that is a reasonable defense. And I think that is a defense that's being made in good faith.
It was clear that that room was rented for prostitution. Is that
purposes,
correct?
That is correct.
Even before this incident,
that is correct.
It's assumed that prostitution had been going on in the room.
That is correct, and evidence by the DNA that pointed to someone else. So I think the fact that you have physical scientific evidence to show the presence of someone who could have been the perpetrator other than Mr. Cuff, I don't see how there can be a finding that the motion is not made in good faith. If he had merely said, I just disagree with what they have to say, such as in Williams and some of the other cases that are not directly on point with us, with this particular case, then perhaps that can be made, such as in the Branch case. But here we have actual physical evidence. I think that it should be made clear that there is a distinction between motion to withdraw based upon coercion or fear and necessarily a motion to withdraw based upon being ill-advised and having a reasonable defense. Obviously, if it's based upon coercion or fear, it's not freely and voluntarily made. It puts him back in the position that he would have been in had he not entered that plea, which is a Sixth Amendment right to trial in which he can invoke any defense, reasonable or otherwise. It's only, and if the court found no coercion, any finding by the trial court is reviewable by this court. So merely because it's a factual finding, it's still an abuse of discretion standard, and to the extent that the court does not consider a significant factor such as DNA evidence or considers factors that are irrelevant such as the experience of Mr. Greenspun, that is an abuse of discretion according to the cases cited to this court. Real quickly, again, in terms of prejudice to the Commonwealth, that is a factor to be considered. That is not a basis to grant or deny. It's just something that gets thrown into the mix. But typically, it makes no sense to say that the Commonwealth is prejudiced if the person is not allowed to withdraw their plea and move forward. I think it's only if they are that prejudice becomes a factor, and it's only a factor. And because they never had these women under subpoena, the Commonwealth was in no different position withdrawing its plea than it would have been otherwise.
Okay. Councilman Frazier, you're out of time.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to come down and greet counsel as is
okay,
custom.
Thank you.
And Ms. Adolfo, if you'll hang on, I think you are up again shortly.